So tonight she's going to talk about what Swami and Yogananda had to say about the future, their predictions about the road ahead, is the phrase we use not only for this class series, but for this journey that's ahead of us, that they hinted and said some specific things that she'll be sharing with us, and we hope maybe clarifying even. And just before we go forward, I want to remind you that next week we'll be having this class again, and it will be Puru Selby, who will be talking about the yugas and how the transition between two yugas, Kali Yuga and Dwapara Yuga, have a great deal to inform about why we're going through the very things that we're going through. And he is a real expert on Sri Yukteswar's yugas. He has co-written the definitive work on the yugas, and he's a very entertaining and interesting speaker. So we hope you'll join us then at 7 next Tuesday. So Asha, let's have fun.
Okay, let's do it. Why don't we start with a prayer? Always better to start with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, help us to understand your will for us in these uncertain times. Help us to receive with clarity and intuition your guidance, your prophecies, your purpose, that we may use everything that comes to us for the betterment of the world and for our own spiritual freedom. We are your children. Guide and bless us. Om. Peace. Amen. Okay, friends. I'm going to push a door open here. A little more fresh air for me. Well, the whole question of, you know, what Swami said, what Master said, Master's predictions. I'm going to hold up, but this is like, it's like such an ancient version of the road ahead. Whenever I hold up copies of books, I look at it and it's like a 35-year-old version with some cover that nobody has seen anymore. No living person still has these books. But I know that Narayan and Dharmadevi with Crystal Clarity just reissued this, the whatever PDF with the beautiful painting of Jyotisha's on the cover, but the contents are exactly the same. So this book is, it's not fat, it has a few pages. The actual words of Master in terms of prophecy in this book are probably about that big. It's like what Master actually said was not a great deal, but what he did say was pretty interesting. So the rest of this book is Swamiji extrapolating from the things Master said, using both logic and intuition, and a certain amount of, you know, economics 101 and a little bit of sociology and a little bit of politics thrown in here and there. And the charming thing about the whole thing is it was written in 1973. So let's see now, what is that? That's quite a long time ago. And it actually includes specific expectations of what's going to happen by the end of the 70s, what's going to happen by the 80s or the 90s, and very briefly when they were going to republish the book. A few emails go around, you know, we sort of, those of us who date back to that time, we sometimes try to compare notes to see who heard something that nobody else heard, because Swami didn't say the same things to everyone. So there was some conversation as to whether we should try to update this in some way so that Swami, so we wouldn't embarrass Swami posthumously for making all these predictions that have proved to be ludicrously untrue in terms of the timing. But of course, that wasn't a really good idea. So it was just published verbatim. I believe Jyotish put an introduction on it, though, just to give it a little context. Swamiji's perspective, and I'll just, I think most of you know, and you if you haven't read The Road Ahead, you really ought to. It's an afternoon read. It's a really interesting book. It's both an historical book and it's a past and future book. It's really, really interesting. But the essence of what Swami was working with was this. When he was with Master as a disciple in person, not hearing it secondhand, hearing it straight up, Swami writes this and spoke of it many, many times. Master thundered is the way Swami put it. You don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming. So Master died in 1952. Swami was there in 1948. And the way Swami put it was, Master was speaking on a Sunday morning, and Swami really thought that on Monday morning, the cataclysm would arrive. There was no sense coming later. This was a very strong sense that we're standing on a precipice, and the smallest zephyr is going to just push it over that edge. So just let me also just say here, I'm going to talk for about maybe 20 minutes, maybe a little longer, and then I would like to just turn it into a conversation. So if anything occurs you that you'd like to ask about, if you could do me a favor of just making a little note, and then we'll stop and we'll go that way. Okay, so Master was very strong about it, and he talked about a great deal of his emphasis on communities was because he saw the time coming when communities would not be a luxury, they would be a necessity. Band together those of you who share high ideals, buy land in the country, grow your own food. And Master talked about enormous economic depression that would make the last depression not very serious by comparison. He talked about the possibility of not one, but two more global conflicts in which he said, Europe will be devastated, Russia will be annihilated, Japan will be absorbed into China. These were very specific statements that he made. He talked a great deal about the terrible threat that communism presents to the world because it's atheistic, because it's entirely materialistic. He wasn't really talking about politics. Everything he was talking about was materialism and atheism, which is really the whole theme of the whole thing, and greed. Greed, materialism, atheism. That's what the issues are. And Master's coming at this time was intimately related to these cataclysmic shifts that he saw were coming. It wasn't like, oh, I'm here, and by the way, this is also going to happen. It's I'm here because this is happening. Now, I'm not going to steal Purushottama's thunder, also because he's so much better at it than I am, and he has so much interesting to say about the yugas. So I'll just reference it, and you can learn next week much more deeply if you haven't read his book, that this is a transition, which we've all heard this before, from a lower to a higher age, from an age of materialism to an age of energy. Now, these transition times between the yugas apparently are awful, because you have this one force that's holding on to its way of being, and these are like cosmic interplays, and I don't live in the mind of God. I don't know why he has to do it this way, but this is apparently how it is, that there's these cosmic forces that are pulling one direction, cosmic forces pulling another direction, and because we're not that advanced as a planet, they're tumultuous. It's also true, and let's back up another step. This is the way I think about it. It's like when Swami asked Master if we always incarnate on the same planet, Master just sort of brushed that off and said, oh no, there's countless planets to incarnate on. And then he gave us the very unpleasant news. reincarnated repeatedly on the same planet, you would, quote, learn too fast. Now, you kind of want to be able to ask him, just tell him, what do you mean you would learn too fast? What's wrong with that? But apparently it's not in the divine plan, so we have to do it in this way. So when we're in the astral world, we need to find a circumstance that will serve our next step karmically. And we could go anywhere. We're not earthlings by nature. We're not male or female by nature. We're just a jiva. We're just a vibration of spirit with a certain amount of darkness and light in us, and the darkness has to be purged through experiences that activate the free will so that the light can be increased and liberated. And everybody has their own pattern. I mean, you're all looking, as I am, at these different faces, and golly shucks, we sure look different from each other, don't we? I mean, just like, even just in the simplest, most obvious way, we're all so different. And that doesn't take anything into account about the incredible subtle realms. So we're there in the astral world. How exactly it works, I don't know. You go to the astral travel, the astral reincarnation office, and they show you brochures of various planets. You know, I really don't know how it works. But one way or another, whatever pattern you're holding vibrates with somewhere in the universe, some planet somewhere, at some yuga, you know, a high one, a low one, a middle one, a transition one, and something goes boong like that, and suddenly you're there. You know, you're waking up in a baby's body and you're there. Now, you have to understand that God considers every child of his equal. You know, we have an inclination to think that Jesus is his favorite, or if not Jesus, then Yogananda is his favorite, you know, or maybe he has a soft spot for Buddha. It's very hard for us to understand that unconditional love means that every jiva is exactly the same. The ocean has lots of bubbles and it just doesn't have its favorite bubbles. You know, there's no like special VIP table for certain bubbles. It's just not the way it works. So that means also, and this is very important to realize, that God, I'll say Divine Mother because it's easier to think about it, she wants to help every one of her children take their next step. And for a lot of her children, the next step is to move a little closer into darkness so that they can experience the consequences of darkness and eventually make the big loop back to light. But their next step is to move into darkness. So yuga transition times, this is how I've come to understand it, and are times when a lot of demonic souls get to incarnate because it's chaos and they get to tear a lot of stuff apart and just they get to be evil and they get to just really wreak havoc. And so where we are when we're in like another famous transition, this one was Kali Yuga, Dwapara descending, but Dwapara Kali shift going down was the Mahabharata war. That's the Bhagavad Gita. And everybody was wiped out. I used to tell that story on these long, once in a while I did it all day, sometimes I did it over several days, and I would tell people at the beginning, you'll know when we've reached the end because everybody will be dead. And I don't just mean by natural attrition. That would be the end of the story, is that everybody would be wiped out. And to God, it's like, what does it matter? That's what Krishna said to Arjuna. You think people are dying, they're not dying. They're just being liberated off their bodies. Krishna says, you see the body fall, I see the spirit rise. And so we each come in and we try to learn. So Yogananda said, Master said, we are in one of those really big transitions, and a great deal of what we think of as normal and continuous and regular, its days are numbered. Now, when Swami wrote this book in 1973, when Master thundered from the pulpit in 1951 or whenever it was, it seemed like it was coming tomorrow. So Swamiji talked about this a great deal, to the point where sometimes the word I would use is ad nauseum. We would just wish he would stop. There was a period of time where every time he came to Palo Alto to give a satsang, it would always be about the end of the world. You know, just get yourselves ready. The end of the world is coming. And I mean, we would sort of talk among ourselves. Do you think we can talk him out of talking about the end of the world? Could we like give him another topic or something like that? Although I have to say, after he died, right after he died, practically the last email we got from him, maybe the last one, was, "I really think you all need a safe haven out of the city." He died in April. In June, we found what has become Ananda Valley Farm. It was the fastest, most successful fundraising effort in the history of Ananda to buy that farm, to pay for it, not have any mortgage. Because Swami had been fundraising for the last 10 years, you know, because every time he came, he told us that this, you know, that hard times were coming. So I think even though like 50 years have passed, and certainly what's been happening is that civilization has been ratcheting down, and it's been ratcheting down in all the ways that Master talked about. Greed has vastly increased, the devaluation of the currency, the inflation of the dollar, the incredible international tensions, the constant threat of things exploding into something worse, the polarization of society, which these are all things Master mentioned, and the word cataclysm to Swamiji, and Master was never explicit on this, but Master did say that the earth itself responds to dissonant human vibrations. And the way Swami put it is, Mother Nature is slow to respond, but when she responds, you really can't do anything about it. So Swami has speculated, because I believe Padre Pio and other prophets spoke of 3 days of darkness. So Swamiji has talked about this. Will the earth stop spinning on its axis? Will we be hit by a meteor? Will the poles reverse? You know, what could happen that could cause 3 days of darkness? And that we should not go outside during those 3 days of darkness. Swami did not say that, but others have said that. But all the causes of that kind of response are just self-evidently in front of us. It doesn't take a prophet 50 years later. You don't have to be a prophet to see it. But the way Swami described it is, most of the time, the population of society is shaped like a cigar. There's a few good people, and there's a few bad people, and then most people just kind of hang out in the middle. And they're not really particularly good, and they're not really particularly bad. But in a transition age like this, it goes like a dumbbell. It gets very, very thin in the middle, and it gets very fat at both ends. And isn't that precisely what we're seeing? It's just everything is polarizing and fragmenting. But now, Master said, and he said it repeatedly, this is all for a purpose. This is not so that the world will go away. This is because we are collectively, speaking of America, which he spoke a lot about directly, but the whole world, we're just totally out of balance. And you can't just flaunt karmic law indefinitely without it catching up with you. And it will catch up with us. But he said it's all for a very profound purpose, which is people are just very confused and they're not happy. And they're not really living what will bring them joy. And so because we're not cooperating with smaller hints, society as a whole is going to be given the opportunity to have a major corrective. Now, there's another interesting part of all of this that Swami emphasized many times. When the world begins to struggle, Ananda will flourish. And we will flourish. And I can talk about individuals in a moment. We will flourish because we are the solution. You know, we are what's trying to happen. And we, meaning faith in God, personal individual attunement to God, not institutionalism, but individual attunement to God, a realization that there is a divine plan. And if I attune myself and cooperate with this, I mean, there has been the implication, Master said it directly, you know, those who love God will be protected. Now, to what degree will that protection come? Will we be protected so far as to say our lives will not be interrupted, that we'll be as comfortable as we are now and we'll just stay that comfortable? He didn't say that. Protected means, who knows exactly what it means. But the point is, all of it is designed to inspire people to forsake greedy materialistic ways, lack of respect and attunement with Divine Mother's planet, a belief that the whole world just depends on ego, and it's just my ego against your ego, and whoever can win, whoever can just overpower the other gets what they want, racial hatreds, religious sectarianism, just basically all the things that we're not, it's like, this is not our life. And so I feel, and Master chose to come at this point, and you have to think about what an avatar's mission really is. Like, there's no avatar who was popular in his own age, because they always come to bring some picture that's going way into the future. And so what's happening now is one reality. Last night I saw part of the film of Hamilton, which, I mean, I'm not going to be here to be an artistic, one way or another. It's enormously popular. It has certain things that are quite nice about it in presenting American values. There isn't one attractive melody in the whole thing. And there's, just this constant whack, whack, whack going on behind it. Artistically, it is phenomenal. It is a phenomenal piece of creative artistic work, absolutely original. On every level, brilliant, brilliantly executed. Having said all that, it's also exactly in tune with the times. It just, the whole feeling of it, it's jagged, it's not graceful, it's hard-edged. And it has a little bit of idealism in it, even perhaps a lot of idealism in it, because that's also there. But the delivery system is harsh. And that's the times we're in. That's why it's so popular. When the children in our community found out, this was decades ago, Michael Jackson was at the apex of his popularity before he took the nosedive. The children in our community found out Swami didn't even know who he was. So they sent some of his music to Swami. Swami listened and was honest enough to say, he said he's a consummate artist. He has a crystal clear vision of what he wants to do. He does it perfectly. He's absolutely in tune with the age, which is why he was a worldwide phenomenon. And then Swami's comment was, and it makes me appreciate that I am not at all in tune with the age, not at all. And that nothing I am doing will be popular while I'm during the span of my lifetime. It's all for the future. I mean, Jesus didn't look like a big success at the end of his life. There was a few folks going around saying he'd been resurrected from the tomb, but there were just as many saying that his disciples had stolen his body in order to make a good impression. And yet, something was planted in the ether that gradually took hold and, of course, began to define the whole world after that. Same with Buddha. So Yogananda's reality is only very, very slightly even hinted at during his lifetime. Because what he did is he planted this power in the ether specifically for the time that we're going through, so that that power would be the pulse that when everything begins to go wonkus, which it's beginning to go wonkus. I mean, here we are talking on Zoom, it's like, and this is like almost normal now. I have my little rig. I know exactly what to do. I just set it all up here. You can't quite see my bed, but it's back behind me. It's all just so, because this is where we are right now. And I think it's going to go wonkuser, more wonkus, I guess is the word. We have no idea what, blah, blah, blah. You can get the whole thing. But yeah, there's this pulse, which is Autobiography of a Yogi, Paramahansa Yogananda, and us. As the heirs, among the heirs, as the children of, and Swami Kriyananda. Swami Kriyananda created an entire culture of self-realization. I mean, I put this in the introduction to Light Bearer. He talked on practically every important area of human life, talked and wrote, created an actual alternative way of living. He created a complete alternative society in the communities of Ananda. It's just like, if self-realization is really the goal of life, what would it look like? Oh, it looks like Ananda Village. What do you know? It's not a dim theory. or thought in the ether, there it is. And it looks a lot like our urban communities. It's most fully expressed out there. But this is what it looks like. As I wrote in the introduction to my book, right now, no one actually cares. I mean, the number of people who care is like, you know, on the planet, it's just, you can't even see it. I often speak of us as one pat of butter spread over the entire globe. I mean, that's about how big our movement is right now. We're pretty hot stuff to ourselves. But nobody else really cares about us. But they will. They will. When in the time of William the Conqueror, I'm no historian, but my friend pulled this fact out. Sri Yukteswar, I believe it was Sri Yukteswar, started a monastery in France with 12 monks because the church was in a pretty sorry condition at that point. That was partly why William came, and that was Master in a previous incarnation. Swami came as his son, his physical son in that lifetime. In this lifetime, he was a spiritual son. Master didn't have physical sons. So Sri Yukteswar, who was Lanfranc, started a monastery in France, Cluny, 12 monks. You think that made any impression on anybody? Like, who cares? There are these 12 monks living some strange life over here. But historically, over the next several centuries, an entire renaissance in the church, in architecture, in art, and music. And it all started with 12 monks because they were empowered by God. And that's why they were born. And they weren't there saying, you know, we are the 12, we're going to change the world. They were, obviously they would be very advanced souls, but we're all very sincere. Even if we're not advanced, we're at least sincere. You know, here we are. And we were up there in the astral world, and Master came down and Swami was coming down. I said to him, at one point, when I was just particularly sick of this age, I don't know what was going on, I said, sir, please, next time, Satya Yuga, can't we just do it in a higher age? Do we have to come into such a mess again? His first response was, I don't intend to come back at all. By the end of his life, he greatly modified that. Basically, his words were, I know myself, he said. And I know that I won't be able to not come back and help you. So Master comes, he comes, we come. And because this kind of a situation is just right for us, because we get to strengthen our spines, learn more renunciation, be helpful to others at times when help is really needed. We wouldn't have done it if it wasn't the right thing for us. But I think let me phrase it differently. Swami has consistently told us that we're going to be in for a very rough ride. Now, here's another interesting piece of it. And ultimately, Master actually says that the fourth world war, counting from number one in the last century, number one and two in the recent century just passed, he spoke of three and four. And four would be basically America standing against the whole world almost. But Swami said something, Master says something very interesting about America. America has a little bad karma, and Swami explained it later, primarily because of the way we treated the American Indians. Because in order to make our country, we simply destroyed them and took theirs. And we did it for greed. And so therefore we will suffer very seriously economically because of that greed. It's a debt that hasn't yet been paid. One would think that slavery was also our bad karma, but Swami said it was interesting that Master didn't mention it. Maybe that was paid off through the Civil War. It's not clear to me. Or maybe the seeds of that are part of what's, because we see it coming, is part of what's helping create chaos right now. You know, some of the people moving in that movement are actually moved by high ideals, and other of them are just getting a chance to scream and destroy. I'm not talking about what color your skin is. I'm just saying the situation gives people a chance to scream and destroy, which is also something that people need to do, because that's, everybody has to have their turn. And people who are not doing that get to stand on the Scott side and not be afraid, because that's what we need to do, is to be able to stand on the side and not be afraid. Now, the whole thing is a battle between light and dark, materialism and greed, and atheism trying to claim for the ego. And this is why Master said communism was such a threat, because communism absolutely does not value human life. Everything is material. So if you're in my way, I'll kill you. That's all. Just as simple as that. Why would I not? Because I'm just here to get what I can. If you don't have God or reincarnation or karma, like, why not? You can get away with it. Why not? But there, it's really a fight of, between light and darkness. Now, I've been sitting for a long time, but increasingly, even just in the last couple of months. If this is a fight between light and darkness, where do I fit? What am I supposed to do? Now, I've always considered myself to be one of the most intensely politically active people that I know, because the problem is consciousness. And I've devoted my entire life to helping people lift their consciousness, because none of these problems are necessary. There's no need for poverty or hunger or anything, none of it. It's all because people don't want to solve the problem. It's because their consciousness, they're angry or violent or feel victimized or want to victimize others. You know, that's what's happening. But there was this very interesting conversation, and I actually think I forgot to put this in Lightbearer, which if I did forget, I might have to put an addendum, one last page in it. There was this Indian teacher named Sant Keshav Das. He's passed away some decades ago, but he was a beautiful, elevated soul, and he and Swami Kriyananda were friends. Sant Keshav Das was from India. He came to Ananda Village. I often cooked when Swami had guests. So I presume I cooked the lunch that day because it was the era in which I would have done that, and then sat at the table. And the two great yogis talked to each other, and they talked about the coming cataclysms because they were both fully conscious. They could both feel the flow of energy and could see where we were going. Swami basically says, just listen to the music. You can hear that people are just gunning for a battle. You know, they're trying to explode is how he put it. Which is what I heard in Hamilton, because it was that rap, bing, 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 very clever, extremely well done. I have to say all that, but the feeling of it was driving to catastrophe. And the music tells you where people's consciousness is. And the dance, as I said, was all harsh, harsh edge. Where does that go? You just keep escalating it. So Sanchi and Swamiji are talking about this. And they talked about light against darkness, but this was the fascinating part, and this was the discussion they had. First, darkness will fight with itself. And darkness will fight with itself for ascendancy. Different elements, different dark elements will fight for ascendancy. And then they said, fascinatingly, and then gradually, so you see that internal fight will gradually weaken the darkness. And when the darkness is a bit weaker, then it'll be light against dark. And so when I think about the progression of all of this, not that I would do anything different than I'm doing. You know, I have been for years giving everything I can to help. So, and living as well as I can myself. But when I look at the world, I look at the protests that are going on now or the politics or whatever, I can have opinions. I can certainly root a little bit more for that shade of gray than that one, but I can't find a place, I'm only speaking for myself, where I can really step into it, because it is shades of gray fighting for each other. Nobody is standing for God. Nobody is standing for self-realization, for Kriya Yoga, for reincarnation, for karma. You know, nobody's standing for the eight manifestations of God. We're not talking about that. We're talking about my egoic preference versus yours. And I do think that some of the shades of gray and black are lighter than other shades. I'm not saying they're all equal, but they're not really at the issue yet. The issue is trying to make equality in the world of matter and just make it work the way I think it ought to work. And that's the fundamental problem, because until we're all moving upward into the light force, that's where the real solution will come. So I'm doing what I'm doing and just standing back from the manifested, from the public arena, because I can't figure out where to come into it. I can imagine a time when it will be clear that there's a place for me, I'll speak for myself, to step into it. But until I see that, I'm going to do the part that I feel I, and I would say we, were incarnated to do. Meditation, satsang with truth, community, God remembrance. And this weird thing that's happened with the pandemic, where Ananda, see this, it's very interesting because Swami said Ananda would flourish in hard times. So this pandemic hits, and it's like Ananda was, we were a quarter of what we are now before we were all put in lockdown. We were all just, you know, like in our particular community, like we had, you know, like an hour and a half on Monday and an hour and a half on Tuesday and an hour and a half on Wednesday. And then Sunday morning, everyone would come together. And so, you know, you have 10 enormously highly qualified people to share, and you're all fighting over an hour and a half on Monday. You're not fighting over it, but there's no space for you. When I started doing my 9 a.m. broadcasts, first I was going to be on 6 days a week. I refused to give up more than one day of my time because I said, no, this is my time. There's 24 hours in a day. And besides that, we're talking to a global audience. You know, what is day to the Indian is night to the American. I mean, it's just like we can be anywhere, anytime. And all of a sudden, everybody globally has figured this out. It's like we have 24 hours a day, and the entire world is our audience. So you can't throw a brick without bumping into a live stream from Ananda somewhere. It's just like, you just can't. It's everywhere. And everybody, you know, people that you didn't know even existed what to speak had such a beautiful vibration to offer because there was no space for it. And we're never turning back. I hope to God we can see each other in person again, because I don't think this is a substitute. But here we are. We're doing what we were born to do. We're tuning into each other. This is our job. What will happen next? Who knows? But if we take care of the minutes, and every minute we're doing what we're being asked to do, then the next minute will take care of itself too. So, questions, comments, thoughts, protestations, cries of agony, anything that you want to us to contribute at this point? So no, no, say it ain't so.
I have a question. It's not really, really related to this class, but it's related to your series that you do at noon, mm-hmm, with the millennials. I've been watching that, and I've really enjoyed it, getting to know everyone's story. The question I have is, I think it was like 2 weeks ago, I want to say, you did a slew of interviews. It was like two brothers from Uruguay, I think.
Barakil and Hazikiel.
Yeah, and then you did one of their wives, but you didn't do their other wives. So I was curious if you were going to do their other wife. Is that his other? I think it was Syria, the one you did an interview.
There is a certain rand that the conversations with millennials was kind of like a yeast bread dough that you leave in the bowl too long. And it just begins to grow all over the place and you just don't know what to do with it. By the time that was over, I did 60 interviews and I talked to 50 different people.
Yeah, because I've enjoyed the interviews. I mean, getting to know how they came to Ananda and everything. I think it's really interesting.
I think it is too. I loved it. Sharmila?
Yes. You talked about the Fourth World War. Right. And I wanted to find out about a Third War.
Third World War. He talked about China, Russia, Europe, Japan, and Swami says he didn't mention America in the Third World War. And Swami thought, will America be in such a state of depression that it won't even be able to participate in that war? This is total speculation. You know, we just have these very, very terse comments by Master where he didn't spell it all out. Swami also talks in this book and in other places. Prophecy is not easy. Even for saints, it's not easy. Even for avatars, it's not easy. Because what they're reading is they're reading forces of energy. And there's free will for human beings, and there's mitigating energies that can come in for example, Mother Mary of Medjugorje, if I'm not, I believe I'm correct in this, said that there would be 10 cataclysms, but because so many people have responded to her message, one of them has already been averted. So it's not like it's cast in stone. It's a challenge to humankind to rise to the occasion. She suggests that people, you know, basically spend 3 hours a day in prayer and meditation. Mother Mary, I mean, Mother Mary is a whole nother phenomenon here. So that's what he said. And that's when he talked about, you know, just the map of the world changing. And then the last war would be, America would be central to that. In other places, Swami has talked about India and America standing together, but India and America are the next yuga. India is the guru of the planet. America is the Dwapara Yuga country. We were founded for Dwapara Yuga. I mean, all this started a long time ago. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men were created equal. That's self-realization. Regardless of the fact that they didn't include the slaves and they didn't include women, it was the best that they had going right at that time, and nobody else was doing it, and we did it. And we set the stage so Master could come here and start this whole thing. Swamiji speculated, as the century came to a close and we didn't really have either of those world wars, that there was nonetheless constant conflict all over the planet. And if you look at it, a whole lot of people on this planet have been living in war zones for a really long time. The mere fact that it hasn't yet, you know, risen to the level of world war does not mean that the world is not at war. But it hasn't magnified. Mainly, it hasn't gone nuclear. Because it's when it goes nuclear, and there are 30,000 known nuclear weapons in the world, when it goes nuclear is when it's going to be a big shift of consciousness. And when somebody came to Ananda and it was when they did the nuclear initiative trying to beyond war. And one of the ways they were trying to persuade us to all vote for that initiative, they had this extremely excellent presentation all mapped out about what would happen if an atom bomb drops on a city. They had some city like Chicago or Detroit. And they talked about how many thousands, tens of thousands would be vaporized without a trace, how many would leave ash, how many would just die within a week, how many would be, you know, forever changed. I mean, we just went out like that. And it was very compelling afterwards, because they wanted Ananda to join them. Afterwards, Swami said, number one, when your objective is peace, fear is not a good tactic. Because if you're increasing fear, you are not increasing peace. I mean, that's the whole premise here. When you're increasing fear, you're not increasing peace. Peace is a vibration of consciousness. So that was the first thing he said. And then the next thing he said was, he commended them first, I have to say, for doing a very good job and for being very sincere. Then he spoke of fear and peace. Then he said, and listen, he said, 100 years from now, almost no one who's on the planet is still going to be here. Whether we dribble out a few at a time for the next century, or all go out together in one big blast, he said, the instant you're in the astral world, it doesn't make any difference. You know, so we have this feeling about death, which is not true. But in that context, Swami said, oh, the number of people who die, that's not a problem. It's the ones who are going to still be here. You know, that's where the challenge is going to come. It's just an interesting way to think about it. Yeah. So, Sharmila, were you going to ask a question?
It's not exactly a question, but it just, when you were talking about the gray, that there's, it's gray, one side or the other, and there's no place to stand. It occurred to me that, you know, with the lockdown and the pandemic all over the world, Ananda initially came to a bit of a standstill and then blossomed. And I can't help but think that maybe this is all part of the divine plan. We didn't know it. We didn't realize that this was really going to take place, but that Ananda has so much energy now going out into the world from all over the world. And this is something we can do. We can't find a place to stand on either side, really. You know, I can't really go march with the protesters because there's anger and violence and there's not harmony and peace. But I can do the things that Ananda does in terms of meditating and praying and going to classes and uplifting energy. So it seems like maybe, I wonder if Swami had a sense that what he was starting was going to, you know, that we were going to come to this catechism and we were going to have a major role in it.
Oh, it's not an if. He absolutely knew it. He was training us for it the whole time. But he himself, you know, he thought he would be here. But it's interesting. He had a prophecy from Bhrikkhu, of the Bhrikkhu reader in India many, many, many years ago. Time will come when there will be weeping in every home. And then to Kriyananda, and you will be the savior of the age.
Wow.
And he didn't mean Jesus Christ like that, but he meant you will save, you will save. So I always heard that he would still be in his body. But of course he isn't in his body, and we're not really at the place where there's weeping in every home. But what was juxtaposed there was that, you know, there will be great suffering, and the spirit of Swami Kriyananda, which is the spirit of Master, which is the spirit of us, will be the comforter. It'll be the comforter. So exactly what you're saying is true. And there's absolutely no doubt. Well, sure, Joe, in Mumbai, just put it perfectly. When all of this happened, he said, I mean, this was really early, one of his very early broadcasts. You know, in a matter of days, literally, the entire globe was just flipped over. Like nothing like this has ever happened. The whole globe was flipped over. And Sergio said, no human being could do that. It has to be Babaji. It just has to be Babaji. And so that's how I've thought about it ever since. One of my morning broadcasts was, who is pulling the strings anyway? You know, because it was just that. So, but between being able to say that intellectually and actually not be frightened or anxious about what's going to happen, that's our job. That's the space. It's easy to say. The job is to transition from that being words to actually being, I'm not lying awake at night worrying about this. And that's a big work. That's super big work. That's much bigger work than who gets elected. You know, who's going to get elected like in the fall? I certainly have a preference about who gets elected. But I know that I represent a congregation that's not political, and I don't know what people think, and so it's not my position to, politics is not my job. But we're going to get the leader that we deserve. As Swami said, the leaders do not determine the karma of the nation. The karma of the nation determines the leader. And so, you know, right now, the president we have absolutely epitomizes the direction the society has been going for a really long time. If I can get it for myself, why wouldn't I take it? What difference does it make how I get it as long as I get it? And that's really what's been going on in our society. Rules, who needs rules? If I can just play the game and get what I want, I mean, there's a vast strata of society that thinks that way. And so we got somebody who epitomizes it. And it just depends on our karma, what the world needs, you know. You need somebody to blow it up. I mean, it's a very impersonal thing to say, but if it needs to be blown up, somebody's got to push the button. And so you've got to have somebody in there with enough charisma to get the job and enough stupidity to do it. So I just don't know what's going to happen. And it might not even be stupidity, because at a certain time, you have to take a stand. And politics and world affairs is their world. It's not mine. Swami Kriyananda was a king many times. He really understood those things. I was so amused once. I have no idea of the context, but Israel had just done something and they had recaptured or taken the Golan Heights from Syria. I hadn't been in Israel at the time, but now that I've been in Israel, I understand. Israel's relatively flat, and the Golan Heights is this place from which the hostile country that owned the Golan Heights just sniped at the poor Jewish settlers for like 25 years. Children grew up in bomb shelters, literally, because of the sniping. So Israel got the Golan Heights, and it was an international controversy. And I remember Swami just saying, just like this, Israel must never give up the Golan Heights. Now that they've gotten them, they must never give up the Golan Heights. And he was just talking like, as the prime minister of Israel, I'm going to say that we will never give up the Golan Heights. I mean, it's force against force. That's the world we live in. There's no clean picture there. But Swami himself said, even in the Second World War, he was disqualified because he had a heart murmur, but he didn't know what he was going to do because, quote, I could never raise a weapon against another human being. It's just that kind of participation was not for him. But it could be for someone. It could be for some of us, you know, that the time will come when that's who they want it, that's who they know they were born to be. So we'll see.
It says, I'm wondering if Swami and Master's prophecies are similar to the Hopi Nation's prophecies. They seem similar.
When you start going, I'd mentioned Mother Mary. When you start running all of the things that have been said, there's enormous similarities among the credible prophecies. I mean, just enormous similarities. But honestly, you don't have to be a psychic. You don't have to be a Hopi. You don't have to be a shaman. You don't even have to be very bright. You just have to look out the window and you can see where it's going. And I love what Swami said about listening to the music. He said, music not only creates consciousness, but it reflects it. I mean, listen to the music. I was vacationing, actually in Costa Rica, and I was in a cottage somewhere and in a place, and I heard what I thought was a public execution happening down by the swimming pool. And I wondered, like, you know, that didn't seem compatible with a resort hotel. It turned out it wasn't actually a public execution. They were playing music at the, you know, at the swimming pool. And it was just the screeching people in pain. And so people are walking around just with screeching sounds of people in pain. And now we have, and I don't like any of this. We now have the melodyless music that only has rhythm, which is, again, a phenomenal presentation much of the time. But it has this overwhelming driving rhythm that just makes you want to scream. And somebody just without any melody at all, just driving through it, often with very angry words. And we all just sit there and keep taking this in. You think, I mean, like, you don't have to be brilliant. And the thing about all that sort of thing is we soon get used to that. So it has to escalate. It has to escalate. That's why Swami used the words. He said, listening to the music, I feel that the world wants a war, is how he put it. The world just wants a war. It wants an explosion. He was just reading the mass consciousness that that's where we're going. So it's no surprise. And you see these forces, you know, you see that people who just want power know how to tune into the lowest element. Swami made a very interesting comment about President Obama. He said he's a very nice man. He didn't agree. Swami was not in favor of government interference in private life. I know that's very disappointing to many political liberals, but that's beside the point. But he said about Obama, and then what it was after Obama, first he said Obama's a very nice man, a good man. That was the word he used, good man. He's a good man. He means well. But then he gave some speech about peace in the Mideast. And Swami said it was a very intelligent speech. The problem with Obama is he doesn't understand human nature. He doesn't understand, you know, the essentially what he was talking about is the dark forces. He doesn't understand mob psychology. He doesn't understand how darkness can be activated. And so he said, he talked from the level of reason. He said, reason is not what's going on in those situations. He said, it's an unfortunate weakness in a world leader not to understand mob psychology. And at the last election, when, you know, I was watching the two candidates, it's like, the one that got elected, he understood mob psychology. He understood it really well. And people who are thinking rationally and intellectually and all these other ways think that he doesn't know what he's doing. He actually knows exactly what he's doing because he understands mob psychology. So that's what's going on, because a lot of demonic people have come into the planet right at this time. Swami said something very interesting in a talk I heard that was given, you know, 25 or 30 years ago that I'm sure I was present for. And it's very interesting that I missed this, but I didn't hear it till there was the recording. He talked about the extraordinarily over-sexualization of our society, just how sex and lust is everything.
It's just that's the way the world is right now. So many children, he said, are being conceived in an atmosphere of pure lust, which is drawing onto the planet a lot of very dark souls. Isn't that an interesting comment? Now, I'm not going to point any fingers at anyone, but he's talking about trends. So anybody with sensitivity and broad vision will read these trends and they can see where they're going. Complete abuse of the earth, absolutely no regard for the living reality of the planet that we live in. Complete disregard of anything being sacred. If we can make money off of it, we'll make money off of it. So guess what the consequence of that is? It's very interesting. Mother Mary has just been appearing really steadily for about the last maybe 100 years. And you know, and in Medjugorje, she's still, for 30 years, she has been appearing to a few of those visionaries still every day. Just a couple of them, but they still see her every day. And what does she do? She warns us. You know, it's time, we must. In Rwanda, I learned from Immaculée Ilibagiza, who wrote the book Left to Tell, 12 years before the genocide, Mother Mary started appearing in Rwanda and warned people that they really needed to come to God or else something, or else, and quote, the rivers will run red with blood. And the rivers actually ran red with blood. And there was a certain elevation of spirituality, and Mary felt to come to Rwanda and warn, go back to Fatima. She was warning Garabandal. You know, so God is on her side. And what God is doing is, for those who have ears to hear, he or she is calling us to use this to grow spiritually, because that's why we came, and use this to make ourselves strong so that we can radiate a force that will help others.
Can you talk a little more about mitigation? I mean, you mentioned it several times. What others should be doing to, or is mitigation not a great thing if God wants to blow us all up so we get the message?
No, thank you very much for putting it that way, Ramurti. That's exactly the right question. This is the purpose here is not destruction. Absolutely not. I mean, it gives God no satisfaction to make such a mess of things. And, you know, she's our divine mother. She weeps for us. Mother Mary weeps for us. Master weeps for us. This is no angry God getting back at us for being such bad children. It's very simple. It's, you know, please, I need your attention. You know, you're not doing the right thing. Listen to me. This is what you need to do. So if we listen and if we run eagerly in the direction that she's calling, then there's no need to set fire to us from behind, because we've already moved the distance that she wants us to move. So whether that's individual or collective, one of the reasons conceivably why the whole thing hasn't blown up yet is because a lot of people, I mean, it's going into a dumbbell. So a lot of people are rushing from the middle over to the spiritual side. You know, there's a tremendous power here, and it's everything is happening on the level of vibration. By the time it manifests in the material world, it's already gone through the causal and the astral realms. So what really changes things is the vibrations that we put out, because then those vibrations manifest. So mitigation is really simple. Do your best to be the best devotee that you can be. And do your best. And of course, understand you can't be a better devotee than you are. So it's not like God expects you to be a perfect devotee. And if not, well, too bad for you. You're just going to get crushed with the multitude. It's just like whatever your next step is, my next step is, do our best to take it. It's a little more urgent than it was yesterday. And our positive steps potentially will have a bigger effect than they would have in less drastic times, because, you know, everything is teetering in the balance.
Master said those who love God will be protected. And all the, most of the prophecies, Master didn't say this one way or another, said that these things can be mitigated. Swami, the question was asked to Swami, can they be avoided? He said, no, he said he thinks the karma is too strong. It's been running for too long and it's too strong. Can they be mitigated on a global level? It's hard to say. Can they be mitigated in the arena in which you live? Yes. There's a story of whatever, wherever the cities were that we dropped the atom bombs on Japan, that there were two monasteries, one convent and one monastery. I believe I have this correct, but this was the essence of it. Everything around them was destroyed and both were still standing. Absolutely made no sense at all. Absolutely none, except that an aura of protection had been created around them because they didn't need the correction. So see, what we need to understand is this is a corrective. And so we need to not need the corrective. If you don't need the corrective, then it won't be delivered to you because we only get the karma we need. So I'm trying to stay ahead of the curve. You know, I'm trying every little blip that I see on my mental horizon, I'm working even more diligently than usual. It comes really simple to trust God. Why am I worried? Why am I nervous? Why am I anxious? Why am I speculating? Why am I tense? Why am I worried for the people I love? Do I not trust God? I mean, everything's the same question. Who's in charge? If I really believed in Divine Mother, why would I ever worry about anything? I don't have a good answer for that question, but I ask it to myself pretty steadily. It's like I'm trying to solve every problem on the level of, why don't you have more faith in God? I've been solving a lot of problems in kind of peripheral ways, but suddenly it's gotten really exact because anxiety is being created because we have no idea what's going to happen. After whatever it was, when California started opening up, and I live in the Palo Alto community. We have a resident doctor, Shanti, who's an angel, absolutely marvelous. But, you know, she's in charge. And I'm in a very strict quarantine, and the house that I live in is a recording studio, and it's in very strict quarantine. And, you know, just I myself personally have sewn about 300 homemade masks and passed them out, you know, I found a contact. They're going out to food banks. You know, I mean, I'm doing my bit that I can do to make it work. That's one way I have gotten involved. I'm sewing homemade masks and they're being passed out at a local food pantry by someone that I don't even know. That's, you know, that was a way I could get in. But let's see. But at a certain point, I just arbitrarily decided that I'd had it. And that, you know, I started being like a rebellious teenager. I started going behind mommy's back and just fomenting revolution. And she sort of wrote to me, Shanti, and said, you know, Asha, this is not helpful. And I had to realize, what the heck am I doing? And what I was doing was, I want this to be over. Just, and that's all. It was just nothing else. I want this to be over. So I'm going to try to make it over. And like, Asha, come on. But honestly, I don't think this is over. Whether we ever get out of our homes and go back to work, whether we, you know, whether the pandemic dies away, I don't think it is over. It's possible that we'll have a respite of something that looks more like the way we've been living for a while, but I think it's much more likely that it is beginning, not ending. So one of the things that I've done, both to mitigate and to prepare, is just really settling in and really working with the weird part of my mind that just thought it could declare reality. And really working with, if this is it, I mean, just being prepared to do this for the rest of my life, whatever it is. I have a woman friend a number of years ago, she actually didn't live anywhere. She was a Swami for a different ashram.
She just traveled. She had no home. She had one small suitcase. That was her life. I traveled a lot then too, but not like that. I had a home. I said, how do you do this? She said, wherever I am, she said, even if it's just in a taxi from the airport to wherever I'm staying, she said, I accept that this is my reality for the rest of my life. And I thought, wow, now that's an exercise, isn't it? Just what is what I'm going to do, instead of always imagining, well, what the word is, live in the now. Instead of always thinking that the present is going to be better than the now, and I'll be a better, happier person when I get to the future. Except the problem is that the future is the now when the future comes. And if the habit is not there to surrender to the now, you won't surrender to the now in the future either. And there will always be that tension against what is. And I sort of feel like we don't have the luxury that we had before. Luxury, I mean, in a literal sense, I think luxuries are taken away from us. We just don't have the luxury. When Paula, my friend Paula, was ill with cancer and eventually died, many of you know the story of her death. When cancer came back for the second or third time she died from it, so it was probably the second. She said she had kind of a slightly childlike way of speaking. Asha, she said, I just don't have the luxury of having a single negative thought anymore. I said, well, Paula, you're about the sweetest person I know, but if you think there's room for improvement. Oh, there's room for improvement. She said, I just don't have the luxury of having negative thoughts. And I always thought about that. Well, I felt I had the luxury. I've taken a lot of liberties with what I know I should be. For me, primarily, it's to worry. I felt I've had the luxury to worry. But I don't feel that I do right now. I was saying, for a few of you who heard just before we went on air live, I feel what I finally said to myself after Shanti called me out on my teenage rebellion, I said, I think that I've entered a monastery. I've just entered a monastery, and it has very strict and different rules. So I'm not living in the world anymore. I'm not living in the world I lived in before. And I'm living in a monastery. And I understand that as a principle. So when you're in a monastery, there's rules, and they don't foster your personal preferences. They work against them. But if you choose it willingly, it becomes dynamic rather than confining.
Looks like there's another question in the chat box from Jaya Devi Andra Denslow. I'll read it to you. I hope I said his name right. I see two directions to go in response to Swami's message about the future. I could go someplace safe out in the country, or I could stay near a city and teach meditation, etc. For those of us who do not live in an Ananda community, what is the right way forward?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think partly it depends if you have children, if you have some, it partly depends how involved your personal karma is with other people. And it partly depends on what the needs and the karma of the other people that you're involved in is. You know, I fly single now. I travel very light. So the only karma I have to think about is my own. I mean, even in this pandemic, as it happens, I'm 73 years old. I think I'm healthier than a lot of people who are a lot younger than me. But Dr. Shanti says that I'm 73 years old and that I need to be sequestered. I shouldn't be taking chances. My choice alone, I'd just be out shopping for everyone and bringing it all in. You know, I would be the one, I would go to the front line. I've been constrained from doing that. But I'm just myself. I would just go to the front lines. But she persuaded me I'm not myself. I have responsibilities in other ways. Because even though I have no personal karma that way, I have responsibilities. So each person has to think, who and what am I responsible for? And then that's the first thing. Do I have the freedom of choice, or is this a committee decision?
based on who else I'm involved with and what the other commitments I've made. You can't just cast those aside. And then the other part is, what do I feel drawn to do? Because we can also contribute. We don't have to be active and visible to be contributing, because this is a war of consciousness and vibration. So you can be alone in a cave and be contributing enormously to the upliftment of mankind. So you have to ask yourself, what is natural to me? What am I being called to do? And then we also have to realize that guidance is a moving target. Today, tomorrow, this is what I'm supposed to do, but on Thursday or Friday, it could turn out to be a different story. So we can't become, this is my destiny. We have to say, this is what I feel to do for now. Just as I was talking about, I don't see any way to participate in the public scene right now, beyond our world, but I could. You know, I know lots of stories of people rescuing Jewish babies from the Warsaw ghetto. I mean, the day could come when there's a clear action that is completely unrelated to the action I'm taking now. So what I want to be is, God, how can I serve? And what do you want me to do? And we have to practice that now. The most important thing in that prayer is sincerity. If we're completely sincere and then we practice having faith in God, overcoming our likes and dislikes, being as courageous as possible, then the next step will be clear to us. You know, at the moment, staying put could really be the answer. The conditions could become where staying put is just folly. It just doesn't make any sense to do it. And that's where we have to come to, if we love God and are acting proactively, trying to be part of what's trying to happen, then we have to also trust that that same current will carry us where we need to go. And if it puts us into trouble or difficulty or death, we have to also accept that that's what had to happen. You know, this is not entirely related, but it's close. I've been associated with a number of people over the years now who've died, often from cancer or something else like that. And all along the way, different decisions have to be made. Do I take this treatment? Do I change countries if I'm living out of the country? Do I do this? Do I do that? And after a while, I've come to feel that I sort of say to people, just do whatever you feel to do and don't worry about it very much, because I think your fate is bigger than your opinions. And as long as you're sincere and you're doing your best, your fate will find you. Your destiny will find you. You can't imagine that I will make a decision that will cause me to miss my destiny. It's just not going to happen. You'll make whatever decision you feel is best. And then when something else is really needed for your karmic unfoldment, it will happen. And that's part of the faith in God. Part of the faith in God is faith in myself. That if I really want to know what's right and I'm acting as sincerely as I can, you know, he's not going to punish me for being a doofus if I'm trying, you know, even if later I realize, what could I have been thinking? It's just that's just part of what happens. And you see, so it all comes back to our relationship with God. Absolutely everything comes back to our intimate relationship with God and Guru. Work on that and everything else will follow. Swamiji once answered the question when someone had an either or decision to make. There was no gray. Either they did this or did that. She wrote to Swami, "Sir, I meditate, I pray, and I just don't get any answer." Swami said, "Oh, do either one. It doesn't matter." He said, and it seemed to matter a lot to her. He said, "Do either one. Doesn't matter. Master is very pleased that you want to do his will." So it's also true that, with all due respect, most of us don't really have a very specific destiny. The Swami remarked once, this woman came and asked him whether this thus and so person that she met was her one and only true destined life partner. And, you know, they didn't get along at all and they were very unhappy with each other. They did nothing but fight, but she was concerned that she was going to, you know, miss the boat. So she wanted Swami to reassure her after she left. He was comforting to her, basically left the decision to her. But he said to me after she left, it wasn't very flattering to her, but here it is. He said, "She has so many lessons to learn. She could learn them with any number of people. Her destiny just isn't that specific. And he said, for almost everyone, it's humbling. For almost everyone, our destiny is not that specific. We're just supposed to love God. And whether we do it in Timbuktu or whether we do it in Paris, France, or Los Angeles, or, you know, in the middle of Montana, God wants us to love him. So concentrate on that, and pretty much everything else will take care of itself. Because we'll be taking care of the main event.
Not that President Obama was perfect, since his election seemed to represent a big milestone, however, and he and his family served as models of decency. What did his 8 years in office and bringing things like wider health care insurance, et cetera, represent or mean in light of the fact that Trump came right afterwards?
Well, it's because we live in a heck of a time. That's what I would say about it. You know, President Obama, to have a black family in the White House, I traveled around the world a lot during that period of time, but I was just so happy that our president looked like a lot of the people I was seeing. It just made me so happy to have a dark-skinned person representing America. It was thrilling. And he's a noble man, and we can all say all those wonderful things about him. What it means that we're just in such an age of contrast is this is an incredibly insecure, unpredictable, God knows what's going to happen time. And it's polarizing. That's exactly what's being said. It's polarizing. We're not going in this sort of straight line. We're going in this thing like this. It's extreme waking up and nobility and goodness and spirituality and change. And I joke about it. You know, I've been in this for 50 years. And when we started meditating, we were so lunatic fringe. I mean, just way out there lunatic fringe. Now in California, it's not that everyone meditates, but everyone who doesn't feels guilty because they don't. And I think that's a huge step forward. So, I mean, that is really the truth. It's really changed. So I think the last president and the present one are just a perfect picture of it stretching out into a dumbbell. You know, it's just like it's just very, very, very extreme times. And the two forces are warring with each other. And I don't think it's going to be clear cut. That's according to the masters, because the harder it gets, what's going to happen is the more darkness there is, the more light there will be. Because people will feel the necessity. What I wrote also in the introduction to Lightbearer is Swami has created this roadmap just of self-realization for the future. Nobody cares right now. But when the inevitable collapse happens, which is either my individual life collapses or society itself collapses, and people start looking around, you know, for what am I going to do now? They're going to notice, oh my gosh, look, it's all worked out. I don't have to reinvent this. It's all right there. And as mass consciousness moves closer to the vibration of Master and Swamiji, they'll become more and more popular because it won't just be this tiny little fringe. And so the harder it gets, the brighter it's going to get simultaneously. And so I think we're just really in for a lot of contrast. And that's part of the reason why we have to stay calm and not just think, oh, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. This happened. You know, we have a new president. It's all going to be different. I don't think so. Even if we have a new president, I don't think the music is going to change. It's going to be the same.
Looks like there's another question in the chat box from Sejal, I think, Sejal. Okay. He says, or she says, I see the Black Lives Matter campaign as a way that we are elevating human existence. When I went to protests, they were peaceful and harmonious. Just a comment that supporting people against the violence that is put upon them seems okay to support and pray for.
I absolutely agree. I mean, that's why I was saying nothing is... It's not like everything is black or because there's shades of gray that all the colors are the same. Of course I'm in favor of all of that. I mean, who wouldn't be? Of course we are. But whether or not I or anyone feels to jump into it, that's an entirely personal decision. I mean, it's self-evident that these are good things. In Autobiography of a Yogi, Master says, you know, Babaji and Jesus are aware of the disturbing trends of Western times, and they're specifically concerned about racial bigotry, religious bigotry, violence, war. So self-evidently, anything that works against that is positive. This is why it's such a strange time that on one hand, look, all of a sudden, people have woken up to something that they really should wake up to. There's a lot going on that's not good, but there's also a lot that's being said and done that does not have a good vibration, does not have a peaceful, loving, uplifting vibration. But it's not my position to say one way or another. It's just a very strange time. It's very frustrating for me because this has happened to me multiple times. I'll say something that's nuanced and all of a sudden I'll get back. Well, are you really against the Black Lives Matter? Give me a break. Of course I'm not. You know, of course we're in favor of all of this. I'm just not talking about that. This is evidence of other forces that are happening, which is it's polarizing. And so much is moving toward light. And we can all point to it. And simultaneously, much is moving toward darkness. And that's sort of what we're caught in right now. So, and every one of us just has to choose our place, wherever that might be, alone in our meditation room, out on the street. But whatever you do, realize consciousness is what's going to change things. So if you keep your consciousness correctly. In 2001, when we were just embroiled in the conflict with SRF, and it was a never-ending thing, and the idea came, which we followed through and did, and the whole group of us went down to the SRF convocation and stood on the sidewalk and passed out literature and chanted and sang Swami songs, and it was incredibly controversial within Ananda about our doing that. And Swamiji, it just went on and on. I've talked about it in Light Bearer. And he said, finally, basically he said, how did he put it? I said, Swamiji, do you really want us not to do this? He said, I'm afraid you'll get angry. I said, oh, Swamiji, you totally underestimate your training of us. You have no idea how well trained we are. We're not going to get angry. He said, Asha, you are so naive. He said, when you set up a confrontation, people get angry. I said, confrontation? Sir, we're going to go down to sing. We're not going to have a confrontation. And he said, when I realized that was his issue, I honestly, and I was right, I thought there wasn't a chance in the world that we would get angry. But this is the deal I made with him. If even one person on the Ananda side becomes angry, you must promise me that you will close up everything and come back. I said, absolutely, sir, I promise. And one person got a little irritated and then realized that he shouldn't and pulled back. But we never did. Now, what was the whole point of that? Because we knew that if we lost the right consciousness, we would do more harm than good. Because consciousness is everything.
Thank you, Asha. Thank you so much for coming and sharing.
Thank you, Asha.
Great pleasure to be with all of you. This is so much fun.